You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Eugene Linden.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show for you. Go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. Any way that you download podcasts, you can listen to it there. I'd like to talk about some sponsors before we get started. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writer's community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experience. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques, learn from a vast collection of free writing resources, make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at Scribophile.com. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've ever seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into that routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach those word count goals. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. It's forthewords.com. That's the number four, thewords.com. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity, but it can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat-in-chair, hand-on-keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal, like spending less than 1 hour per day on email, to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours a day on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off our Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time with Rescue Time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Eugene Linden on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book. It is called Deep Past, and it's one of those books that I'll read a chapter and have to stop and think about it, and then the plot and the characters keep me pressing forward. So it's kind of the best of both worlds, and I think you guys are really going to love it. Welcome to the show, Eugene.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for taking time to do this with us today. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That's interesting. I think back in high school, I probably thought about it. And then I went to college and I thought about it more, and mainly because I couldn't think of anything else to do. But I think I always thought that writing, you know, you can sort of bring together everything. When you go to grad school in one discipline or another, you're kind of siloed. But with writing, you can sort of maraud around in any kind of field. In any event, I studied writing fiction, creative writing with Robert Penn Warren. I had the privilege of doing that and thought I would, you know, start off and go in right into fiction right away. And another writer who was somewhat older told me, he said, no, you got to get some life experience before you launch into writing fiction. You actually have to live a bit outside of college. And he didn't follow that advice, by the way, but I did. And I thought, well, maybe I'll spend 10 years doing nonfiction journalism and stuff like that and get back to fiction. And of course, 10 years turned into 20, turned into more. But I always planned to get back to writing fiction from nonfiction.
Well, let's talk about your nonfiction work. You have been writing for, gosh, I guess the better part of 40 years.
Yeah, more than that, actually. Shame to say. Afraid to say.
Tell us, what is the thing that has driven your work?
Well, I've been, I guess one dominant question that I've been exploring in all sorts of books and articles is, how is it that this one species has come to dominate the biosphere? And what is it about us that we've become a geophysical force? And, you know, how is it that we changed from, like one question that I think about a lot is that if we disappeared off the map 20,000 years ago, say, we're the same as we were then. But if we disappeared then, we wouldn't have left a trace. If we disappeared now, we've utterly reworked the world. So we've become this enormously consequential species. And I sort of explored all the byways of that. You know, what is it that gives us our rights in nature? What is it that enabled technology to flower the way it has, the consumer society to evolve? What is it makes it different than other creatures? And that's a strong motif of my career is writing about, you know, our intelligence versus animal intelligence. What are the commonalities? What are the differences? Things like that.
Did you approach your nonfiction scientific work with a thesis? Did you have a clue what you were looking for, or has your writing and the work you've done taken you to places you never would have imagined?
Well, both, but you're the first person who really asked me that question, and I've been waiting for it for a long time. I'll tell you, I had an idea. I had like almost an epiphany or vision when I was in college just about how the consumer society worked. I mean, what is it about us? I don't want to get too deep into this because it'll slow things down, but I had this realization that it's like a perpetual motion machine because it's sort of driven religious needs to the margins, but those needs don't go away. You know, as I go into psychology and Jung and people like that. And what has happened is that at the margins, these sort of needs for something beyond material rise up, and they're captured as consumer interests and transformed into consumer interests. So what I realized is that the consumer society is kind of like a perpetual motion machine that actually its mobilizing energy are the very discontents that it causes, and it captures them and that energy, and then that energy drives purchases and drives the consumer society. Now that I've reduced a book called Affluence and Discontent just into four sentences or five sentences there, but that was the kind of central vision I had. And then most of my writing has been exploring various aspects of that idea. And how it emerged, where it came from, you know, what were the tributaries in Western thought, things like that. I don't wear it on the sleeve of any book except for Affluence and Discontent, and then another nonfiction book I did a few years back called The Future in Plain Sight. But that's sort of at the core of things. And then that's led me in many directions, and of course I've discovered new things along the way to, you know, that's why I say both.
Sure. The new book, Deep Past, explores the idea, and you've touched on it, that that humanity is special in some way, if you want to use that kind of word, that and maybe special just because we dominate, but that we in geologic time we showed up on the scene in the blink of an eye and have dominated the entire discourse of everything. When did you start realizing that this was a thing and kind of putting that into perspective. When did that focus come into view for you?
Well, a long time ago. It was kind of the origin theory of all my writing, was wondering about how we achieve this special place and the incredible short amount of time it took us to do this. When you think, and this is what led to this novel, by the way. So when you think about it, organized brains have been around for over 500 million years. Our intelligence flowered in really a few hundred thousand years. I mean, you know, you can go back 3 million years when we began to, 5 million years began to diverge from other great apes. But really, it's the past few hundred thousand years that saw a tremendous surge in brain growth, right? That's a blink of an eye geologically. So that's one thing. The second thing is, what I've discovered in writing about animal intelligence over all these years is that it's much more widely shared, that some degree of intelligence and awareness is much more widely shared in the animal kingdom than we ever realized, say, 40 years ago. And it turns out that having some degree of intelligence is a kind of efficient adaptive strategy. You can't hardwire an animal for every eventuality. So you see, you know, primitive and types of decision making and problem solving and all sorts of animals we wouldn't expect. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is that, as I mentioned before, if we'd gone extinct 20,000 years ago, we would have left no trace. So I put those together, all those ideas together, and I thought, gee, if we could come along in a blink of an eye, as you say, over the great span of history, who's to say some other intelligent creature hasn't arisen and gone extinct? And that's the central premise of Deep Past, is the discovery of this ancient intelligence. And it draws on all these big ideas I've been exploring over time, ideas like the idea of convergent evolution, which is that over time, you know, evolution will optimize an animal for a particular ecological niche or task. You know, like a pangolin and an anteater are incredibly different, but they look almost exactly alike because they do the same thing. And I wondered, maybe that applies in the realm of higher mental abilities as well. Another big idea was, it's a subtle idea, I think. It's called the notion of an ecologically surplus ability. And I know that's a heavy-handed phrase, but what it means is that maybe you equip an animal to do something, like you give a dolphin extraordinarily sophisticated sonar, and with it comes as an added benefit a kind of smidgen of consciousness, or whatever you want to call it. And so maybe our intelligence and consciousness and awareness is a byproduct of abilities that developed in response to prosaic, you know, ordinary evolutionary forces, you know. And then another idea is that this notion, there's two ideas. It's island biogeography, the idea championed by a great biologist, E.O. Wilson, which is that in islands, there's less diversity. And so animals can grow or shrink to occupy different ecological niches that on the mainland are already occupied. And so you get evolution gone wild. In other words, on the island of Crete in ancient times, there was a mammoth that shrunk to the size of a Great Dane. On the island of Anguilla in the Caribbean, there was a rodent that got to be 300 pounds. So, you know, island biogeography or the island rule can give you basically a mouse bigger than an elephant. And so that idea, you can see how in an island situation, some adaptation might go wild. That adaptation might be intelligence. So I pulled from all of these different ideas, and I thought, well, gee, you know, you could make a plausible case, a pretty convincing case of something truly what seems impossible and fantastical, which is intelligence on our scale appearing and disappearing in the past, but which was entirely, you know, based on, you know, defensible science and credible theory. And that's, you know, the thought experiment that gave rise to the book. Then I wanted, I just figured that it would be a far more visceral and vivid way to sort of tell this story in fiction rather than in nonfiction. And it was easy enough to embed it in a geopolitical thriller context because the find takes place in a very volatile part of the world.
Right. In the same way that an astronomer or an astrophysicist ponders the vastness of the universe and our place in it can be very humbling, as you're dealing with looking into our past and our place in the world and then contemplating things like that we could have gone extinct 20,000 years ago, and the precarious nature of our very existence. As you start learning more and writing more about this and digging into all of the discoveries that you've made, does it have that same effect that you're just awed and humbled that we're even here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole idea, is that there's so many accidents that happened that led us. A lot of them have nothing to do with our intelligence, for instance.
Right. We're very lucky.
The last 8,200 years have been a Goldilocks climate for humans. You go back 3 million years with or 2.7 million years to the start of the ice ages. I mean, there have been 100,000-year periods of complete climate upheaval. And they actually shaped our evolution. I mean, in an odd way, climate change and natural climate change, bad climate, was good for building humans. And, of course, once we were built about 200,000 years ago, good climate was necessary for our expansion of numbers. I mean, 10,000 years ago, there were probably 5 million people on the planet. And that number rose to maybe 210 million by the year zero in the Christian era. And now we're 7.4 billion. Even during the Little Ice Age, which was started in about the 1300s, 1400s ended in the beginning of the 19th century, Europe's numbers stagnated for 400 years. So, you know, weather, which we don't really think about, and that's a key element in this book because it has to do with the disappearance of this ancient species, is really the, you know, let me control the climate, and I will give you any species you want, including humans, it turns out. So, yes, it all puts our grandeur into perspective. You know, we've been around for 200,000 years or whatever. What's the bet that we're going to be around for a million years, another 800,000 years? I'd say they're extremely low odds. They may be, we may be lucky to get out of the next 100 years. So, absolutely. The intelligence that I imagine in this book flowered like 5.5 million years ago. It came and went in a similarly short period of time, a few hundred thousand years. The trace that's found of it is really at first very minimal. So that's what I'm trying to show there, is that, over the grand sweep of time, no matter how dominant a species is, it can disappear without a trace.
Well, the new book Deep Past reads not like science fiction, which in a way it is, not like space opera science fiction like we think a lot of times, but this is based on really sound research and things that we're discovering now, and it really reads like it's torn from today's headlines. What are some recent discoveries or maybe some ideas that have become more mainstream that maybe weren't 20, 30 years ago that allowed this book to feel so prescient at a time like now?
Well, I think the main one is that 30 years ago, or I would go back a little further, 40 or 50 years ago, it was almost absurd to think that any other animal besides humans had any intelligence whatsoever, that there was continuity between animal and human intelligence or language. In a period of a couple of generations, what we've seen is evidence has just piled up that a lot of different animals have the capacity for symbolic thinking. A lot of different animals have what we would call consciousness, which would be awareness of others' mental states, for instance, which actually in evolutionary terms gives you a big advantage. I mean, if you can fool somebody else or understand what somebody else is thinking, you've got a leg up. So it is selectively advantageous. So the notion that this is much more widespread in the animal kingdom than we would have imagined 50 years ago. You know, I guess when Planet of the Apes was written 50 years ago or more, probably. But that was fantastical. Yes, there were chimps, and they'd flowered and grown intelligent. But now, I mean, it's much more reasonable to understand that there's some degree of intelligence all around us. Why not? Why wouldn't it be the case that some other intelligence on our experiment, basically an evolutionary experiment, might have come and gone in the deep past? Because it doesn't take that much time to build it. Yes, you need to build a brain and you have to have certain aspects of it. And I think one of the other interesting things that feeds into this, and this is my own discovery as well, is that, you know, I always shared the prejudice that you're the most likely place to look for intelligence is in these big brain creatures like the great apes, whales, elephants, things like that. The octopus is a fantastically interesting creature. Some percentage of his brain, whether it's 40 or 60, is in the tentacles. It's neurons. It's a relative of the clam, and yet it does extraordinary problem-solving things. And actually, you know, there's anecdotal evidence of, you know, like even showing a sense of humor, for instance. And it's just the least likely creature you could imagine. So if there's some degree of like in decision-making intelligence in an octopus, you know, which has been around for hundreds of millions of years, you can imagine that all sorts of creatures might have developed or found the right circumstances in which intelligence might have flowered in the past. And I think that's the eye-opening thing, which is that we don't have to have, it doesn't always have to be an ape or a whale or something else to look for intelligence. There are any number of creatures which might have intelligence. So like birds, parrots, and crows don't have large brains because they can't. They gravity, you know, you have to optimize for weight. But they can do very sophisticated things in terms of showing problem-solving abilities, understanding of words, even understanding of syntax. So I think that's the big change that sort of permitted me to do this exploration.
Well, and I think those are very great examples that you gave us. The Planet of the Apes, I think, really plays to our prejudices in that we assume that as another creature evolves, that they're going to evolve more like us.
Right.
It was a planet of apes that had become like us.
Right.
And we assume that forward progress means becoming like us. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the truth. And I think the octopus is an excellent example of that. So as we look to the past and start realizing that maybe we're uncovering things that didn't become like us, but that doesn't mean they're not advanced, what do you think that means for the future? As we watch the world around us and see how things are moving forward, and maybe not in the way that we assume would happen?
Well, it's a complicated answer, but I go back to that notion of convergent evolution. In other words, I think that a mental state that is where people are trying to gain advantage in a very a large, complex society is going to converge on a kind of type of awareness where you can fool other people, where you can understand their mental states, and that will occur in a bunch of species. But I also think at the same time that the mode through which the intelligence flowers, go back to that notion of ecologically surplus ability. In other words, if it comes out of some pre-existing ability that's solving a utilitarian issue, like having an extraordinary sense of hearing or this or that, it'll shape the type of intelligence you might have. And that was part of the fun of this book, because I got to explore in inventing this intelligent creature, an intelligence that's in some degrees like ours, but in some degrees extremely different. If you get into the book, you'll see that the intelligence that they discover, you know, is extraordinarily sophisticated in some ways, but much more benign than ours. It's much more at home in a world of, say, like quantum mechanics than we are, where, Einstein never could actually accept that, that's the way the world was structured. So, I think there's no, to go back to what you're saying, there's absolutely no inevitability that whatever successive intelligent species arrives and takes our place, you know, because in over the next several hundred million years, has to be like ours. It's not like we're an evolutionary experiment. By the way, at this point, it's not going particularly well. So, it's conceivable that some other more different type of intelligence, more harmonious with the needs of the planet, might emerge at some point.
Yeah. Well, the book Deep Past, I know we've talked about some kind of big, heady, scientific topics that definitely inform this book. But this is a page-turning thriller. This is fiction that makes you want to keep pressing toward the end of the book. Tell us about Claire Noland and what's the story that starts taking place here that gets Claire on this adventure?
Oh, okay. Well, Claire is a 32-year-old scientist who's frustrated and has been frustrated in the past in exploring animal intelligence. She's working in Florida at an elephant research on infrasound with elephants. And because it's going so well, there's a problem. It emerges, her funders have a problem with another an archaeological dig in Kazakhstan, where the leader of the expedition has been taken sick and had to be evacuated on an emergency basis, and they need somebody to temporarily look over it. And because her project basically runs itself, they ask her to take the university and the foundation that's funding her ask her if she'll take a temporary leave and just oversee this project until the guy comes back. So that puts her over there, and you know she's actually. Without giving too much away, anyway, she's brought over to oversee a project looking about the domestication of horses, you know, some many thousands of years ago. And then there's a giant mining concession near her project, and the head of security comes over with a discovery of his. I won't go into what that was, not of his, but something they found in the most remote part of that concession, and it shocks her. And what happens from there is there's a leitmotif of the book, which is the difficulty of a scientist who makes an extraordinary new discovery, bringing that to light without that discovery being dismissed as like cryptozoology or something like that. In other words, it's not so much what you discover, but who believes that you've actually discovered something that's important in science. You can discover anything, but if you can't get published in the right journals or whatever else, you're consigned to the fringes. And there's an immune system in science, in the scientific establishment, which is a healthy thing to some degree because it protects it, you know, from undisciplined ideas and things like that. But it also protects it from new ideas to some degree. And one of the fun parts of the book are Claire's struggles in trying to get this discovery to the light of the day when basically everything is stacked against her. One, it's an outlier idea. Two, she has to deal with corrupt officials in the area where the discovery is made. She has to deal with basically Cold War great power conflict and geopolitical shenanigans, and then the machinations of this oligarch who has aspirations to take over the whole area. And so she finds herself in the fighting battles on all fronts, on the credibility front, and then ultimately she's fighting for her life at one point. And it was interesting to sort of lay this story into this geopolitical thriller context, because I started writing it some years back. The plot centers on is Russia's desire, and the desire of certain oligarchs in Russia, to sort of reconstitute the Soviet Union. And of course, since I began writing it, they invaded and seized Crimea, giving a great deal of credibility to what happens in this book at some point. So all of these, she's sort of navigating all these various minefields throughout the book. But there is one, to get back to this, one of the more fun parts of writing this was sort of going into the incredible kabuki dance you have to do in science to sort of bring a new discovery to light and have it actually be listened to.
Well, it's really an interesting metaphor for the kind of macro luck of the very chance that we're even here, and all of the things that had to happen for us to survive. This deep past is really kind of a micro look at that through Claire's journey. Is that all of the things that had to go right for her to get this discovery? It's more than just making the discovery. The fact that anyone will ever know about it is another miracle of luck. That everything has to work just right. It's really fascinating the way that plays out on a micro scale.
Well, I mean, that's the largest point of the book, which is that intelligence occurs in a social context. In other words, her journey is really speaks a lot about the nature of intelligence itself. In part of the book, I have people talking about what human activity best expresses our intelligence. And in a playful way, I use poker, the card game, because on the one hand, you need quantitative intelligence. On the other hand, you also need social intelligence, and you need a fantastic memory. And I'll give you a brief example of why I think that. Somebody I know is married to a physicist at MIT who is fantastic at online poker, because, obviously it's anonymous. And he thought he was so good, he went out to Vegas and joined, one of the World Series of Poker things and got slaughtered, because it turned out that he didn't have the social intelligence and the kind of ability to mask his own emotions that's necessary when you're playing with other people. So in terms of quantitative intelligence, the guy was off the charts. In terms of the kind of, intelligence that makes a difference in the world, he wasn't, at least in this particular case. The other players were, in essence, quote-unquote, more intelligent than he was, because they had all the various aspects of intelligence. And that's one of the things, I hope the reader would take away, is that the slippery notion of the notion of intelligence, it's not just one thing, and it always occurs in a social context. And if it has no impact on the world, does it even exist?
Eugene, do you think there are any recent discoveries that may be coming to light or have come to light that will help us to continue to challenge these notions of that we're it and there's never been anything before us?
I've been asked this question a couple of times, and I struggle with an answer, but I think if intelligence itself is a useful adaptive strategy that's widely spread in the universe, in the biosphere here, and not some freak accident that occurred in only one species, but is part of a continuum, I think it's highly likely that at some point we are going to discover evidence of something like what I posit in this book. Because nature is always experimenting, and some things work out, some things don't. And the things that don't work out, we stumble upon. Now look at what's happened recently. First, there was a discovery of what are the so-called hobbits about 5 years ago, these tiny little relic species that still were struggling to figure out what they are. They are human-like, but diminutive. They look like Homo erectus, but they lived, you know, 50, 60,000 years beyond the expiration date of Homo erectus. And that totally scrambled the map of our evolution. Now, like a month or two ago, a discovery of another diminutive species on an island in the Philippines. And so what it's saying is that the evolutionary history of humanity is, you know, not this arrow leading to us, but a far more complex picture with lots of different experiments of creatures of different sizes, with different skills, with different brain sizes. And then we just happen to, you know, be the lucky ones in the end of the day. And so, yeah, I think that everything we've, the things that we've been uncovering and are utterly reworking our view of our place in the world.
Our human family tree is more like a sprawling bush with
right,
little shoots.
Metaphor,
and, yeah, all of it. Well, Eugene, I absolutely love the new book, Deep Past. It makes us think in ways that a novel hasn't made me think in quite a while. But more than that, or in addition to that, it is a fascinating, thrilling read. And I absolutely love it. I'm sending everybody to get their copy of it. It's out, available everywhere now in hardcover, ebook edition for your Kindle or Nook or however you consume those, and audiobook. Eugene, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into your massive back catalog and all of the great work that you've done and follow along with news for what's coming up next with you, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Yes, EugeneLinden.com. It's pretty easy.
Excellent. Well, we're going to send everybody to see you, and we're going to send everybody to pick up their copy of Deep Past. Thanks so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to HankGarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
He led Jason to a small bistro. The door set tiny bells to chime as they entered. The place shivered with smells. Coffee, hot chocolate, and croissants. "This," he said, extending his arm towards a woman in an apron, "is Jennifer. She makes the best scones and is tragically spoken for." He kissed the woman's hand. She was plump, in her 50s. She had left one curler to dangle at the back of her head this morning. "If it's a tragedy to you, this is the first I've heard of it." She swatted at him with a menu. "Why didn't you speak up 20 years ago, lady killer?" Jason sat. Jennifer put a glass of water in front of him. "And who is this fine gentleman?"
"This," said Hedwick, joining, "is my son's great-grandfather's great-great-nephew."
"That's a lot of greats. Any great-great-great-whatever of Hedwick is great by me." She giggled at her own wit. "I'll be back for your orders." Hedwick swatted her rear end with a menu as she left. He made small talk about the bistro, the specials, what was good, the Benedict, or not so, the hanger steak. When their orders came, coffee for both, eggs for Jason, a scone for himself, he got down to business.
"I met your grandmother about, a year ago. Valerie and I have a mutual interest in old families, particularly old families related to the legend, for obvious reasons. Valerie's lived in Tarrytown for years, though her family's up near Boston. Now, don't worry. I don't believe all that nonsense about a headless horseman. Valerie's the superstitious one. But the Van Brunts are definitely the family in Irving's story. Hermanus Van Brunt and his wife Agatha were farmers in the village back in 1780 or so. This was during the Revolution. Hermanus grabbed title to lands left by a Tory family who'd been tarred and feathered and shipped back to Britain. Do you know your history?"
"Sure. Tory. Loyal to the king. Benjamin Franklin broke with his own son, who was a Tory."
"Smart boy."
"Traitors to the cause. And that was serious business. The British marched straight through here during the war, chased George Washington off Manhattan and out to New Jersey. And after they were kicked out again, a lot of Tories were kicked out with them. Anyway, the Van Brunts took over some farmland north of Tarrytown. They had a son, Abraham. And, of course, their son Abraham married a wealthy heiress. Katrina Van Tassel. Yes, all that is true. It's public record, just like the legend says. My mother left behind quite a few documents written by Abraham Van Brunt, Brahm, in Dutch, mostly. He was powerful around here. With Katrina's money, he became the biggest stone merchant in the state. He died in 1850. After him, it's Dylan Van Brunt, his son, Joseph, the grandson, then Cornelius, then... Sorry, genealogy is not my thing. No? Why was Eliza doing research on the Van Brunts? She wasn't. She was looking into the Cranes. That's what made us such fast friends. I don't get it. We do go back a ways, your family and mine. More coffee? Jennifer appeared at Jason's elbow. Hedwig nodded and she poured. Still not getting it, said Jason. But he did. Hedwig turned to the waitress, and Jason knew what he would say. My lady, may I present? He raised his coffee cup, proclaiming, the last descendant of Ichabod Crane.